The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, hope you're enjoying March Madness, the fourth and final BS Report of the week. I do have some good news. I am pretty much done with my rough draft of my book, which means that much like Jimmy Chitwood when he announces at the Hickory High dinner or whatever that was that it's about time he starts playing basketball again, it's about time for me to start writing columns again. Thank you again for your patience. I am almost done. The book is very important to me. And I had this weird epiphany like a year ago that, you know, what happens if they destroy everything on the internet, some weird internet terrorist or something, and my columns will go up in smoke. At least with books, they can live on and Amazon and used bookstores and Building 19. At least there'll be some sign that I existed other than the Red Sox book. So I'm throwing everything I can into it. It's going to be a long ass book. You'll get your money's worth if you enjoy my columns or the NBA. And you will see the hard work of the last 3 years, hopefully. Anyway, for this last BS report, I've been fascinated by this A-Rod story and just him kissing the mayor and the whole thing and just how A-Rod, this just gets weirder and weirder. So I wanted to have on the guy who wrote the story for Details Magazine that got so much play this week. His name is Jason Gay, and he is on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline right now.
Hey, man, how are you?
So when did you spend time with A-Rod?
It's really weird. It happened literally the night of the day that Selena Roberts confronted him down in Miami. So the day,
oh my gosh.
The timing of this story is really wacky because it was already in the works, you know, long before any of the steroid stuff had happened. And the idea of it was to, you know, he's got all these people around him now, like Guy Fieri, Madonna's manager, and so on, and they kind of want a position. And, you know, this is, again, a month ago, 2 months ago, they were thinking, you know, let's position this guy kind of as a, you know, David Beckham, Tom Brady, Tiger Woods type brand ambassador. You know, I mean, it's sort of a laughable premise before any of this stuff happened, but I think that was sort of the idea.
And he had signed, he had just signed with William Morris, right? Or
yeah.
He switched agencies, yeah.
Yeah, William Morris working for him as well. And I think that, like, I mean, it's a really, the guys obviously had, PR problems long, long before any of this stuff happened. And it was kind of an odd thing. I mean, he is, on the face of it, what you would think would be this immensely marketable guy. You know, he had huge athletic accomplishments, good looking, you know, reasonably good on his feet, talking, you know, he just had all the kind of things that typically you'd think Madison Avenue would want, but for many reasons it just was never working, and I think they were trying to sort of push that through.
Right.
And this was sort of maybe part of that, and it sort of just, of course, has all come crumbling down.
How much do you think Madonna had to do with that?
I think she had quite a bit to do with it in the respect that there's one thing that a few people have picked up on, that if Stephen Klein who took those photographs is basically Madonna's like pet photographer. I mean, he's a very, you know, well-respected fashion photographer, has been so for a very long time, but he's basically been the one doing all Madonna's like big campaigns and, you know, magazine spreads and stuff for a really long time.
Right.
So
I love that. Go ahead.
It was no coincidence that's why he was the one with A-Rod.
Well, I just love the thought of the photo shoot with the guy like, okay, A-Rod, now. Okay, go to the mirror. Yeah. Go, yeah. Look at yourself. Yeah. Kiss. Okay, now kiss. Like, it's just, I wish there was video of it because I bet it would have been fantastic.
I know, right? I wanted to go.
Oh.
And I couldn't go. They closed without, I mean, they, you know, sometimes photographers like, they don't mind having reporters around, but this situation, I wasn't allowed to go. I was begging to go for that reason because it was like this grimy little boxing gym in Miami and, you know, kind of had all this, you know, they, you know, part of that thing is sort of the CD, like, kind of element to it. And It must have been pretty hilarious to watch.
So did they contact your magazine to do the story, or did you guys contact them?
That's a good question. I actually don't know, like, who called who. I mean, I assume that details reached out. I'm not sure if it was generated from the A-Rod front. I mean, another thing about that, I mean, you sort of indicate, the guy's got a lot of advisors. You know,
right.
He's got Guy, he's got William Morris, he has, you know, Rubenstein PR in New York, which is a very big public relations firm here, not to mention the Yankees, not to mention, now he's got a whole, group of, former Bush White House communications people helping him with his crisis management.
Seriously? Is that true?
Yeah, no, he's got a company called Outside Eyes, which is, I think it's actually a Southern California company that specializes in crisis management, and a number of the guys affiliated with that firm are former Bush White House communications people.
Wow.
Which is, like you'd want those guys. I mean, just that White House was not exactly a communications, expert shop. I just don't understand.
Yeah, it's true. You know, A-Rod and Kobe, I think, of any athlete in the past decade, or any athletes in the past decade, have been the two guys who seem to have spent the most time cultivating their own persona. You know what I mean?
Right.
No decision seems to be ad-libbed. Every decision, every move seems to be picked.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word. So,
but I think that's a really good comparison. I think Kobe is a really, apt, comparison to A-Rod. But I think that one thing that struck me about Kobe is that he kind of sort of embraced the bad guy eventually. He finally just was like, I can't, make everybody think that I'm, all-American apple pie kind of person. He kind of got a little bit more badass, and that's when things started to switch for him. A-Rod just, you get the sense that he just can't handle even the smallest fragmented amount of bad publicity, which is super ironic now, but he just can't, his willingness to be the bad guy, I don't see it in him.
You mean when Kobe named himself after a black cobra? That was telling to you that he doesn't mind being the bad guy? Yeah, Kobe definitely, he got a couple tats.
Yeah.
He seemed like he was interested in refurbishing his street cred to some degree, whereas A-Rod just seems like he wants to be liked. He's like Sally Field at the Oscars.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so you hung out with A-Rod for, as you said, right, as the Selena thing was breaking, but before... You basically hung out for him the whole day, right? Or with him?
It was a dinner, and it was a weird, weird circumstance because, first of all, the location of where we were going to eat was there was all this sort of, his handlers deciding, oh, we can't go there because he's going to get bothered, and, he's going to eat, but it has to be quick, and he's not, all this kind of, back and forth with his handlers as to the particulars of how this was all going to go down. It felt like, I was meeting a mafia don and we were going to split cars halfway through.
Right.
But, it was what it was and he gave a good amount of time but it was so surreal about it is, I come out of this thing hoping basically he would address two topics, which was Madonna, which was the thing everybody wanted to talk about. And then the other thing was, the Tory book, which, was hot right at that moment.
Yep.
And he did both things, and I'm like, man, okay, I got the stuff. I have what I want. And then the steroid scandal breaks 2 days later. I'm like, I have 50,000 shares of pets.com. No one wants anything of this stuff. It's the whole context is everything with this interview.
So you're basically, if it had happened, you were screwed. Because he wasn't going to give an interview afterwards.
Right.
And you had an interview that took place in the old A-Rod world that no longer existed.
Exactly. And so you were, we tried heck, of course, to get him to get back on the record with us. But other than doing the Gammon thing, you pretty much shut it down other than the press conference. I went to that press conference in Tampa, which, everyone saw. But, it was the way to do the story then, because you had this essentially meaningless dialogue with the guy, was to try to contextualize it. And it really was, to me, kind of interesting that here we are with this guy the night he gets the first sign that his career, his life is going to change forever. Mm. And he sits down comfortably for this interview, talks about all sorts of, basically comparatively goofy stuff, and then does the goofiest, well, not goofiest, but, super glammed out fashion shoot the next day. I mean, this, that photo shoot wrapped up literally about 12, 13 hours before SI posts Selena Roberts' story.
He knew it was coming.
He had to. No one gets confronted in the gym about a failed steroid test and be like, I wonder whatever will come of that. I'm sure that there had to be these behind-the-scenes machinations, what's going to happen, how are we going to respond, blah, blah, blah. But maybe there wasn't. Maybe he was just totally in denial. I really don't know. I would have loved to have been able to put the question to him.
Well, he was definitely in denial when he told Katie Couric that he'd never used steroids, as he said after. He said, maybe I didn't want it. I wanted to believe that it wasn't true, or whatever rationalization he came up with.
Yeah, that seemed like a Twinkie defense to me. I think he flat out lied. Possibly. I think it is true that these guys contextualize performance-enhancing drug use in such a manner that they normalize it and don't think it's illegal.
Right.
But I don't think that, he clearly knew what he was doing at the time, I think.
It's almost like a leading a separate lives thing, like those people that they have a wife and a mistress, and they have these two separate romantic lives, and they just kind of pretend they don't.
Absolutely. Exactly.
So Buster Olney on our Buster Olney writes a great baseball blog for ESPN.com that everybody should read. It's just really good. It has all the relevant links. So he wrote about A-Rod a little bit yesterday, and basically came up with this A-Rod being A-Rod premise, which I could describe like this. Manny being Manny, we always hear about that. But A-Rod is a little bit the same way, where his teammates, he doesn't even really faze them anymore because he's so kind of out there and so different that they're just kind of used to him. He could basically do anything and they're okay with it. When you talked to him, did he seem like a normal person to you?
No. Not in the respect, obviously not in the respect. He obviously is this celebrity, but I think also just in terms of normal conversational thing, just even the most banal kinds of questions, like what do you want to have to drink, or what kind of shoes you're wearing. Just like things that aren't even trip up kinds of questions. You can see hear the wheels in his head. Consideration of everything, and it just sort of makes for a strange kind of dialogue.
So he's somebody that has to process every decision he makes before he officially makes that decision.
Yeah. It's
having a glass of water or anything.
Yeah. I think that he's just suspicious. I think that he, obviously got burned kind of early on in his career and feels like he can't be himself and he has to be super careful with what he says. But, of course, the opposite is true, especially in a town like New York where people love to forgive, villains and castaways and things like that, and just doesn't seem to get that the way for him to get over this hump, and maybe not, he'll be able to do it now after everything that's come out, is to be an actual normal person and not what he thinks is an actual normal person.
Because I spent time with Tiger once, and granted it was only like a half hour, but he's the same in that he's very deliberate and cautious, but at the same time, I knew that there was, I knew that if I had become friends with him, or I knew him in college or whatever, I knew there was a real guy underneath the whole thing, and he was just doing what he had to do to protect himself.
Yeah.
A-Rod, I think, is the same way, except that I don't think he knows what's behind him. Where Tiger is like, Tiger knows, but A-Rod is like, I'm not sure who I am. It's almost like he's become the public A-Rod. That's just his personality, and he has no private A-Rod.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. And I think that, it's funny because Tiger, I think he sort of dialed it back after. Remember there was the GQ story years and years ago where he told the lesbians joke, and then that was it. They shut it down in terms of him being, doing any kind of off-the-cuff interviewing.
Yeah.
A-Rod, the thing that I'd like to hear and I'd like to see exhibited more is, there is kind of a cocky swagger to the guy. You can tell that he thinks he is the best, and he can certainly make a good case for it. And, you want to kind of hear that a little bit out of him publicly. I don't think it's a smart thing to do right now, but there is, I think, an inner core of the guy that is probably pretty entertaining in a sort of cocky sense.
Gotcha. I don't know what to make of the guy. The two people that, not to bring up Kobe and A-Rod again, but those are the two guys that I just can't figure out. for the life of me. Kobe to me is the biggest enigma that we've seen really since I started writing about sports, which I guess we'll go back to 1988, but I just can't get a handle on the guy. Like, I saw a rough cut of Spike Lee's documentary about him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're showing his wife and his kids, and they're holding Daddy for MVP signs, and then it ends with him getting in the car with his family, and the image that he wanted to perpetuate was Kobe family man. But, you know, I'm not sure I'm sold on that image, you know, and I'm not sure why he's so desperate to make me think that he's like that.
Yeah.
And with A-Rod, it's the same thing. It's like, what is your ultimate goal here, A-Rod? Why do you have 40 people handling your image? Like, what are you, the president? Like, I just don't understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get it.
Question for you is, you know, I think he believes, and the people close to him believe, that what's going to happen is he's going to win a title and do something, you know, exquisitely dramatic and return the World Series to New York where it belongs in his mind.
Right.
And everything will be forgiven, you know, that he will go down as one of the great Yankees and the streets will be paved with gold. And I don't know. I mean, certainly people will be psyched for that, and I think that it'll help restore his reputation in the city. But I don't know. I mean, Kobe's won some titles.
Yeah. I, for whatever reason with baseball, people just can't forgive the steroid thing.
Yeah.
Because it messed up the numbers from a historical sense. I've kind of come around on it, and now I just feel like, all right, now we pretty much know that nearly everybody from 1992 to 2008 was doing something.
Yeah.
So maybe we should just kind of let it go and figure that, you know, as sucky as it was just part of the era, just like Babe Ruth never played against black guys. Like, you know, every era had something that differentiated it, and maybe this is what differentiated this era. But
I think so. Yeah.
It just seemed the difference with A-Rod, and Bonds had the same quality, is that there's something about him that it seems like a lot of people just instinctively dislike. He's fun to root against. I like rooting against A-Rod, and I have no rational explanation for it. It's fun when he plays the Red Sox and we strike him out.
Yeah.
And that's part of being a fan. I mean, you're going to have guys you like and you don't like. And for whatever reason, it's fun not to like him. I'm not sure how he shifts that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, to take the steroid admission, you know, I went to this press conference and, you know, for all the sort of, you know, comical explanations and, you know, things that he said that made no sense, it was, on the face of it, probably the most detailed steroid confession we've seen from a superstar in this era. There's no question about it. And people are like, you know what? He just should have been like Giambi. You know, Giambi didn't say jack. You know, he didn't say anything. But Giambi was a far more likable player. He was a very well-liked teammate, great quote to the press, you know, had a great reputation going into any of the stuff that he had to deal with. And so, you know, A-Rod, people were just primed to hate him, and I think that that existed much, much longer than any of this stuff.
Yeah, and it's a little different with Clemens, where people respected him, and then he kind of threw it out the window, and the turn became very venomous against him. A-Rod, it was more like people were happy that there's suspicions about him and finally been confirmed. I don't know. There was a weird undercurrent to it. The Clemens thing was just kind of like, you bastard, you lied. Like a lot more raw hostility. So of all the celebrities that you've written about, who was like the most, who was the anti-A-Rod? Who was the most normal?
Letterman.
Really? When did you read about Letterman?
I did an interview with him about 6 months ago for Rolling Stone, and
I read that. Oh, I didn't make the connection. Yeah, okay.
And you know, I'll be totally honest. I mean, it was a total, you know, wish assignment for me. You know, I always wanted to interview the guy. I grew up watching him, and you know, I think he, you know, he massively influential broadcaster. And I just, you know, if you listen, you know, like, going through that interview and listening to it and transcribing it, you're like, he didn't say a dishonest thing in the entire 3 hours. There might have been things that he liked talking about more than other things, but he just came across as so genuinely authentic. And that's not a word you necessarily associate with Letterman. I mean, because he can be, you know, pretty caustic and mean-spirited and, you know, hard to work for famously. But I just felt there was a, you know, a genuineness to the guy that you really seldom run across anybody who's got a high-profile life.
Hmm. Hey, and that's honestly one of the reasons why I love the guy. And
yeah.
I think it seeps out sometimes, and you definitely saw it seep out after 9/11.
Yeah.
He was the one guy with a late-night show after 9/11 that, you know, you could kind of share the experience with. He was
right,
like a buddy.
Yeah, because he came across as a human being. It wasn't like some boob from TV who was trying to, like, figure out how to act. He was just kind of acting like the rest of us.
Yeah. Hey, Letterman, you know, I don't know what keeps him going with that show. It's kind of fascinated me. You know, I've always had this theory that if you showed 1983 Letterman, the guy that we grew up with, if you showed him a tape of what his show is now, I think he'd have a heart attack. Because his initial show was a parody of a talk show.
Yeah.
He was, you know, all the stuff that they do now where they have little, like, intros and the band's playing, you know, these little intros to each little bit that they do and all that. He hated that stuff in 1983. So I don't know whether he's come around on the whole thing or whether he's just, like, accepted that this is the only way you can succeed in late night or what. But I don't think he'd ever talk about that.
I think he did in degrees talk about it in the respect that I think he's very sad about the way that these shows have basically devolved into these, you know, marketing schemes. You know, like virtually everybody who comes onto the show is plugging something, you know.
Yeah.
Movie star, band, whatever. And everything that we remember, you know, not just the format of those shows in the early NBC days, but the people who went on, weirdos. You know, people had no business being on television.
Yeah.
You know, Harvey Pekar or Sandra Bernhard or Tony Randall are all the people who, you know, were the great guests. Chris Elliott, you know. You know, they would never find the time of day on an 11:30 show anymore. So part of it, I think, is the time change. Part of it is, like, getting older. Part of it is he makes a ton of money, you know, probably feels obligated to, give the network what it wants. I think, you know, I think people still care about late night. I think it's a pretty interesting time right now.
I agree.
That's happening.
The one thing that bugs me and the thing that's changed, and I don't, you know, I'm analyzing this from afar and I don't know Letterman, but I don't think he's ever totally gotten over the fact that Leno, you know, in the mid-90s, just basically ripped off all the stuff Letterman was doing and did it in a much broader, kind of stupider way, and then passed him in the ratings. I think, in my opinion, from Letterman's standpoint, that I just think that was a huge blow to him creatively, just like, holy crap, like, this guy has dumbed down what I'm doing and not come up with really any original ideas, and he's beating me. Like, this is just an indictment of how dumb TV viewers are.
Oh, absolutely. I think it goes even further back than that. I think he's never gotten over the fact that NBC gave Leno the show in the first place. You know,
no,
I think that
never.
He always has felt that CBS, no matter what sort of incarnation, it's interesting because CBS is a much more kick-ass network right now than NBC is, just across the board, ratings-wise. I think he's always felt like it's, you know, second rate. And it certainly is in terms of its late-night traditions. But I think, you know, you're absolutely right that he's sort of never gotten over the way that Leno has ridden ahead of him, but he also probably never got over getting snubbed in the first place. And so now what you have with Conan and Leno moving to 10 o'clock and all this, like, weirdness, I mean, it's a strange time. And I know that they're pretty excited over there about the idea of going head-to-head with Conan. I mean, I don't know if it'll bear out, but I think that they think they're, you know, it's in play, so to speak.
Well, and I also think people wonder with Conan, like, his ratings, how much of it just had to do with the Leno lead-in, how much of it had to do with his actual number of diehard fans. And we're going to find out.
We will find out.
The good thing is that we're going to actually have an answer. you know, I will say, like, when I worked for Kimmel's show that first year, and granted, we made a ton of mistakes. And there's no question, and I'm sure Jimmy would do over 20 different things if he could. But, you know, you learn, it's trial and error, you learn as you're going along. But the one thing that really bummed me out was sitting in on those focus groups and learning, you know, hey, here's this unique part of this show that works, and we're still trying to figure out how to make it work better, but now you have to just remove it.
Yeah.
You know, like, we had co-hosts the first 4 or 5 months, and it was really good, and it gave each week, like, an identity. You know, you had Mike Tyson week.
Maybe you had,
Yeah, Snoop Dogg week. And sometimes the co-hosts weren't as good as others. Like, but on the other hand, like we had Jeff Ross as a co-host. It was probably the single best week of shows that we did. But anyway, yeah. We go into these focus groups and they're like, yeah, the focus groups, they don't like the co-hosts. They need continuity at night. They're half asleep. They need structure. They want to see the same thing every night. They don't want to be worried about that they're going to get a curveball thrown at them. So just make every show the same.
Yeah.
And it was just so depressing to hear that, you know, that's the best way to win in late night is that you make Monday night show and Tuesday night show for all intents and purposes seem exactly the same.
And you have to, again, to Leno, I think that's what he's done, and I say that with all admiration of his success, but there's a real consistency tonally, comedically, and even the kinds of guests that go on the show.
I'm not against Leno. Like, he did what he had to do to win, whatever. But, and we know from the 80s, and you know from watching him when he appeared on Letterman, all that stuff, that the guy is funny as hell. And he was probably the best, the best guest Letterman ever had consistently.
Yep.
So I think he's done a lot of what he's doing because it's the best way to win and make the most money. There's something to be said for that. But at the same time, it's a little depressing that's how you win. But you spent time with Jimmy. Didn't you spend time with him? I think it was like March or April 2002, right? As the Man Show was ending, but before the ABC show was taken off?
Exactly.
So what were you thinking then?
Well, it's funny because I think that everyone just assumed that Jimmy was going to do this kind of like, be sitting there with a sudsy beard doing kind of Maxim style, late night show, and that was the sort of box that everybody was putting him in. And I remember talking to him and him being like, I hate those guys.
Yeah.
and being like, wait a second, okay. So like there was sort of this kind of Death to Smoochie quality of like what his life had become on the Man Show, like where he would just, I he obviously respected those folks who made him what he was, but he was eager to move out of it and get, and I had a real sort of studied appreciation for late night. I mean, no one I've interviewed has a sharper sense of like the people who had done it before and how they did and what made them great than he does.
Yeah.
So there was like, I was like, well, maybe, if ABC is counting on some sort of like frat style show, they're probably not going to get it out of this guy. And clearly it became something quite a bit different than that. And I'm impressed that they're among the shows that really have an opportunity here. I'd like to see them move it up, in terms of time slot.
Yeah. And unfortunately he's running out of time because if you're going to make that move, you want to do it now. And I'm not sure what they're waiting for because you want to be on before Conan goes on. On the other hand, I don't know if 12 o'clock is necessarily a bad thing because now your first half is going against basically their second guest on each show.
Yeah.
And then the second part of your show is going against Jimmy Fallon and Craig Ferguson.
Yeah.
Have you seen Fallon's show?
I have, yeah.
It's actually a little bit further along than I thought it was going to be. And I think
agree with that, yeah.
It from a production side. Like it's very well put together. I remember when we started, we didn't have maybe the experienced guys running things that Fallon show because they pulled basically all the guys from SNL that had been behind the scenes. The thing I'm not sure about is if he's funny.
Yeah.
I just don't know. I don't know if he's one of those naturally funny guys.
Yeah.
So I don't know how far the show will progress. I don't know.
Yeah.
In 9 months from now, will it be better than the show I'm watching right now? I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, I interviewed him not that long ago, just before the show started, and he's quick on his feet. I think that, and that's not a insignificant, quality. I think you got to be quick on your feet in the show. He's got a sharper sense of humor than people who just think he's kind of the cutesy SNL guy that, the girls liked. I think there's a little bit more to him than that. I think that hiring the Roots as the band was really smart.
Yes.
All the music freaks are into that and they'll watch the show just for that, seriously. And I think the other thing he has going for him is, Lorne Michaels is his producer and no one got creamed like Conan got creamed. I mean, it was a different era, but the kind of abusive, hostile reviews that Conan got, no one's going to get those, and Fallon hasn't. So, the fact that NBC and Lorne Michaels stood by him through those fires, I think, helps somebody like Jimmy Fallon out. But, you know, I just think that what NBC is doing with three back-to-back-to-back talk shows, I mean, they're just going to fatigue the audience. It's really weird.
And that's why I wrote in a mailbag, somebody asked me for, like, more predictions because I had nailed a prediction. One of the predictions I had was that Leno is going to be back at 11:30 within a year. And people were like, why do you hate Conan so much? And it actually has nothing to do with Conan. No. Conan has been put in a situation to fail and fail miserably. He's got this show coming on at 10 o'clock before him every night in the same city that he's in that is going to just get better guests. If I'm Jennifer Aniston and I'm promoting a movie,
yeah,
do I want to promote the movie at 10 o'clock on NBC on primetime or do I want to go on Conan's show at midnight? I'm going to go on at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just think it's so unfair to him to do that, and you know, I've argued about this with a couple people. I really feel like they just didn't want to pay him the $40 million,
mm-hmm.
and this was a roundabout way to kind of screw him over and ruin his value so that, you know, like if they had just paid him off and kept Leno at 11:30, he could have gone to Fox, and he would have been like the victim. People would have been, oh, poor Conan, and it would have been the best thing that happened to him. Instead, they basically cut his knees out, and I don't know how he's going to fight back to that. How do you see that playing out?
It's an unenviable situation. I think that, you know, if you were able to get him, you know, to truthfully talk about it, that he would, say exactly those things. It undercuts him and it puts him in a very vulnerable situation in the event that it doesn't work.
Right.
One thing that I'm super curious about is I'm not super convinced that 10 o'clock is some sort of, like, undiscovered late-night haven. I have a feeling that Leno's show is successful and, you know, really bright Leno has been about the late night form. It's not the same thing. It's a little bit different. And I wonder if like Leno out of the gate it's gonna be maybe one of these kind of things like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was when it started where like, you know, there are gonna be like four or five nights of Leno in the top 20, you know, like Nielsen ratings. But over time, you know, people are just gonna be like they're gonna want something else. And what you look for in television, you know, and for the few remaining people who watch television on appointment, what you look for it at 10 o'clock is a little different than what you look for at 11:30. And I'm very curious to see how it plays out in the ratings. I don't question that it's a smarter move for NBC than putting on, you know,
Kings.
Christian Slater, whatever junk. But I just don't see necessarily that it's this sort of long-term franchise-type feature because you don't hire these guys for, like, two seasons. You hire them for hopefully a generation.
Yeah. Well, here's what I'm fascinated by. And having worked on a show, I know how hard it is to come up with to make sure you have a good 45-minute show. Because even if you have a band, you know, basically if you watch any late-night show, the last 20 minutes are all commercials and then either a comic or a band. That's where they backload all the commercials.
Yeah.
They basically front-load the first maybe 35 minutes of the show with the material. So you can't do that at 10 o'clock. You have to string out. If anything, you want to be peaking in the last 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, he's got to kind of reinvent what we think a talk show is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if anything, you don't want your best material in the beginning. You want your best material in the last 20 minutes, which is just, it's almost like watching Memento for a talk show. You're going backwards. I don't know how he's going to do that. And I don't know how you put on 5 hours of talk shows without having a band. Because you're not going to bring a band out. You're not going to bring out Clint Black in the last 10 minutes when half of your audience is going to turn the channel.
Yeah.
So what do you do? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, Jennifer Aniston.
And back. And we're coming back with segment 4 of Jennifer Aniston. She's going to talk about Marley and Me again. I don't know. I don't think it's going to work. And that's why I think he's going to be back within a year. I think this is a rare case of he's screwed at 10 o'clock. And Conan is equally screwed trying to follow him at 11:30. And then who knows what kind of effect it's going to have on Fallon. I assume that's going to be great.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe, you know, Kimmel gets a bump because people, you know, or Conan, people move over there. And maybe Letterman gets a, you know, last hurrah and gets a chance to beat him head to head. I mean, I guess it's a funny, you know, TV is so changed than what it was when we were growing up, but one area that is weirdly static and interesting is late night. It's just kind of like network news. People still kind of care. There's always that segment of population that just cares. It's weird.
Yeah. The one difference, though, I think, is that because there's so many channels now, and it seems like some of the cable channels have been able to hit niches. Yeah,
true.
Colbert and Daily Show. that's hitting like the super smart, I keep track of politics and, you know, that kind of audience, whereas 30 years ago, the late night hosts had to hit basically everybody.
True, but we're forgetting something, which is that, you know, Obama's doing Leno. You know, like a sitting president is doing Leno. No one's ever done anything like that before. It's unprecedented, and I think it's very interesting that he chose Leno over Letterman.
Because he knows Leno's going to throw softballs at him.
But does Obama need a softball interview? I mean, I'm curious about that. I mean, I was like, I understand. I mean, if I was George W. Bush, I'd choose Leno. But
if you were Obama, though, you're not going on Letterman. I'm sorry. You're going on Leno. I mean, put yourself in his shoes. You're going on Leno. You are.
Well, I mean, it's clearly a message-driven idea. Like, we're going to get this guy, and this is sort of like the old school, like, FDR fireside chat. You know, he's going to sit there on his couch, and I'm going to lay out my economic plan and why everyone should chill out.
Yeah.
But you don't think Letterman's going to give him that opportunity? You know, it would be a much more, I mean, I wouldn't say aggressive interview, but I think it'd be playing at a faster pitch speed.
Yeah. I wanted Jimmy to have the president from 24 on, but I guess he had his show book because he wrote like, and we have the president too, and then it would just be the female president or the madam president as they call her.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know how we got on this subject, but this was fun.
Yeah, right.
What else are you working on? Anything?
I am hopefully going to be doing something about Green Day, the band who I've never talked to, and they got a big record coming out, and they've kind of, you know, it's weird. You know, they were the young band not that long ago, it seems, and yet they're these elder statesmen, which is kind of bizarre. And that last record was, of course, huge. And I don't know, I respect them. I sort of, you know, was late to admire them, but they've obviously done pretty amazing things.
So what are the magazines you're writing for right now?
I'm working for GQ, Details, Rolling Stone, a few places.
Is there a website that we can find all the accumulated stuff?
No, I don't. You know,
oh
there,
my God!
There is a
How
space,
dare you?
Can I tell you something? There is a JasonGay.com, but it's owned by a Christian folk singer. Well, not only that, but he changed his name to Jason Gray because he was so horrified that Google searches of his name were drawing up all these pornographic websites. So he legally changed his name to Jason Gray. So I think he needs to abandon the URL, frankly.
Yeah, maybe you could buy it off him for like $50.
Yeah,
all right, thanks for coming on. It was fun talking to you, and good luck with the Green Day piece.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Hello, John O'Connell.
Johnny.
Wow. Are you on a plane or something? That was like whispered.
Somber Johnny today.
Somber?
You know who you're following?
Who?
Well, we just had the writer from Details who wrote the A-Rod piece that features the picture A-Rod kissing the mayor. Just talked about A-Rod for 25 minutes. Yeah, you missed it.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah.
Hey, you're not going to believe this, but he thinks A-Rod's kind of strange.
No, shocked. I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. He said he's the kind of guy who had, who seemed to have to think about it just when he was like deciding what to order on a menu. Like, what would be the right order for Jason Gay to appreciate him as a person? That was the name of the writer.
It's troubling.
Yeah. What did you think of that piece?
Well, I saw the excerpts of the photos, and I was thinking, you know, earlier, and obviously it's obvious to anybody that's ever listened to a podcast, your podcast with me on it, that I'm more than willing to be Nathan Thurm and be a complete apologist for all things Yankees.
Right.
And I am the guy who is always like, let's circle the wagons, let's get off A-Rod's back, and he's a Yankee, and rally around the pinstripes and all that. But then something like that comes out, and it's just like, A-Rod, I mean, are you thinking about Yankee fans at all? I mean, my first question was, who is advising him? Does he have any advisors or people?
We just found out from Jason that not only does he have some advisors, he's got like four different teams.
And
he's got like his agents, his PR people, the Yankees, and then he uses Bush's old White House advisors, apparently.
Yeah.
He really does. That's not even a joke. Yeah.
I thought that was surprising.
No, unfortunately, not a joke.
There was nobody there that was willing to jump in front of the camera, in between the camera and the mirror, to stop that photo. I mean, what is the guy thinking about, like posing, making out with himself in a mirror, basically?
Yeah.
Posing languidly on a bed, like lifting his shirt on a mattress. I mean, does he ever think about Yankee fans and the fact that many of us work with and are friends with Red Sox fans and the grief that we're going to have to put up with for that photo shoot?
Apparently it didn't enter his mind.
It's absolutely indefensible. I kept thinking to myself, like, if you cut off A-Rod's head and replaced it with, like, Kevin Youkilis's head, the joy I would feel, I mean, I would have had to take the week off and buy the most expensive champagne and just to enjoy the moment. And so that's what Red Sox fans have, as if they don't have enough ammunition. It might be a case where the Red Sox have too much ammunition. Mm. It's like, do we go A-Roid? Do we go A-Fraud? Do we bring mirrors to the game? I guess you do all three, really. I guess
it's too much.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
It's too much. It's like, as we've talked about the podcast before, our roommate who fell asleep on the toilet and pooped on the floor and threw up in the garbage can.
All right.
And it was like, it was almost too much, and now we can't be, now he's not friends with us anymore.
It's like when you see, like, little children and you take them to, like, the circus or something, and it's overstimulation. It's just too much sound and color and everything at once. That's what it's like for Red Sox fans right now with A-Rod. It's just too much. Too many jokes. Too much, you know?
I have a great photo of my daughter at the first Clipper game she went to, just deer in the headlights, just staring at the Jumbotron. It's kind of the same thing. Just total sensory overload. Kids have the best look for that.
That's what the Red Sox fan has been like this offseason with A-Rod, who's the object of their scorn and hatred, and maybe justifiably. I mean, a guy at work told me about those pictures, and I'm like, really? Kissing himself in the mirror? Sounds a little odd. And then I saw it, and I'm like, oh, my God, no. Oh, just no, A-Rod. Just for the love of God, no.
A-Rod, what is that?
Right?
It's a full-length mirror, and it's very good.
It's me making out in a full-length mirror with myself.
I remember all the times in college when I tried to get you to pose for a picture kissing a full-length mirror, and you just never, ever took the bait.
Exactly. I was wise enough to take my own counsel and not pose in such a way.
Hey, you know, we're taping this podcast on Thursday as March Madness is going on.
Yes.
Right now there's 12 minutes left in the Cal State Northridge Memphis game, and it's tied.
You know, I've got Memphis in the Final Four. That's going to cause me some problems right there.
It's not really March Madness until you lose a Final Four team by 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
I was hoping it wouldn't be on the very first day, the very first game, but apparently it's going to be.
Holy mackerel.
Cal State Northridge.
So, Johnny, you entered
I guess I answered all the questions about the toughness of Conference USA. Isn't that the conference Memphis is in, and they've won like 80 games straight or something? And they're like, yeah, but they're still a good team. Maybe not so much.
Yeah, maybe that conference isn't really cutting it.
Apparently not.
Johnny, you entered our BS report bracket.
I did.
Which you can find on the ESPN main page. We put some of our favorite BS report guests are at the top of the bracket, but we had a lot of entries. It's going to be fun, and we're going to have to come up with some sort of cool prize for the winner.
It's up in the thousands, I think. It was last night when I filled out my bracket, I believe, the entries.
Yeah, they said something like, I don't even know. Joe Mead, do we know a number?
It's like 19,516 down there.
And we could have more if you guys join. This is all Joe Mead's idea. Joe Mead, it's about time you earn your keep, for God's sakes.
Good work.
I mean, seriously. But anyway, the sports gal, I entered her bracket, and there's really no doubt at all she's going to win. The one thing, though, both you and her have UNC.
Really?
Yeah.
That's good. One more thing we have in common.
Johnny, are you sad that we're not spending March Madness day one together?
I am. We had such a good time. What was that, 2 years ago? Me, you, and Joe House?
Yeah.
Out in L.A.
We'll do it next year when I'm done with my book. We'll definitely.
Very good.
We're going to make it happen because, it's been 2 years. Since what do we do? All day Thursday diary, and then we did Friday half day. And Joe House ate so much food that we could not move him with a cattle prod.
See, I liked it because I could start drinking at 9 o'clock in the morning, and nobody looked askance at me. So.
That's right. It was totally justifiable.
Right.
How was your St. Patrick's Day?
It was good. St. Patrick's Day itself was a little. Was a little subdued. It was a Tuesday, you know, it was work day, but the Saturday before was the big Hartford St. Patrick's Day parade. It was a lovely day out, lovely by Connecticut's March standards. It was like 50 degrees or so, 50 or 55, so we'll take that. It was a sunny, lovely day, and went out with a bunch of my friends, and we watched the parade and had some post-parade revelry, so it's always a
nice.
Good time.
Yeah, Tuesday for St. Patrick's Day is a terrible day.
It's awful. It's not like you can go out at lunch and hoist a few, you know. So,
yeah, Monday is like Monday. You could talk yourself into it, but Tuesday is just a day that's just Tuesday tells you no fun.
So my wife and I went out after work, and we went for dinner and had some corned beef and had some Guinness, but it wasn't really, you can't really, like, go nuts on a Tuesday, you know. Wednesday, you're back at work, so it's like an odd time for St. Patrick's Day, sadly.
You know what's funny about, you know, like, the last 10 years with women, the way their eating habits and people finding out, like, people soy lattes instead of a latte and all that stuff.
Mm.
Feta cheese on a salad instead of blue cheese. Everybody, like, all right, this is what you have to do to be healthy.
Right.
Then you look at the Irish.
Yeah.
Corned beef, cabbage, and Guinness.
Yeah.
I don't see that on Jennifer Aniston's plate. She's trying to lose weight.
Not a healthy thing, sir. No, that is correct. No, that is not really health food. No.
When they have the Us Weekly diet for this is how Tori Spelling lost 50 pounds of pregnancy weight. You never see corned beef on there.
No, probably not high on the list. No, the Irish are not famous for their salads.
My wife made corned beef and cabbage for St. Patrick's Day. It was delicious.
Excellent. Very good.
See? Yeah, it was really yummy.
You have some Irish in you, I think, so that's good.
A little, about 25%.
Excellent. There you go.
Fortunately, the top half of my body.
Hi-ho.
Hey, quickly wanted to ask you about World Baseball Championships.
The WBC.
Are you watching?
I caught a little bit when the United States played Canada, but that was actually only because I was flipping the channels that happened to be on.
Yeah.
And so I watched that. I watched like the ninth inning of that game, which was a raucous Canadian crowd.
Right.
It was in Toronto and the U.S. won. But I can't really say it's been appointment TV for me that I've made a point of it or followed it at all closely. I was more into it 2 years ago because I had a friend that played for Canada, so I was kind of into it because for his involvement in it. But he didn't play this year, and I really have no interest. Like, there's really no bragging rights, as far as I'm concerned, of the USA won or lost or whatever. And I'm just more concerned about Derek Jeter being injured in it at any point, in which case I'd just be so outraged at Bud Selig. Not unlike the injuries the way you must be feeling after the injuries to Pedroia and Uke.
I hate the World Baseball Championships.
Yeah.
I think it's so stupid.
It's idiotic. I mean, it is so
I hate
dumb.
It.
Either spring training is, you know, these guys haven't played in 6 months, so it's the get in shape for the season, stretch and loosen up and ease into the season, or it's to play full out from the get-go, and that's what these guys are forced to do. It's a hideous mistake.
You look, I just don't think professional players should be used for any of this stuff when they're under contract and they have an obligation to the teams and their fans and all this stuff. Like, look at, well, you don't really follow NBA, but San Antonio Spurs.
Right.
Ginobili hurts his ankle in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
It's an injury that he needs a couple months to heal. It's finally like about 85-90%, and the Olympics are coming up. He's got to play for Argentina, so he plays. Makes the ankle worse, and he's never been the same, and it's probably going to cost them
a
realistic chance at the 2009 title. I don't see how that's worth it. And if I'm an NBA owner, you know, and these guys – yeah, I hate to use the word own, but these guys are properties that they own.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, ruined San Antonio's chance to win the title probably. And then you look at what happened to Euclid, or I also don't like putting miles on relievers in March. I just have a lot of problems with it. You're putting high-pressure innings on these starters and high-pressure innings on the closers, and meanwhile it's March 12th.
The other thing is, yeah, these guys went left after like a week of spring training to go with their WBC teams.
Mm.
And you're not loosened up enough to swing full out. And then, you know, I saw that Canada-USA game. It was fairly intense in the ninth inning.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I won't say it was like World Series atmosphere, but it was arguably playoff atmosphere. So to go from, like, not playing for 6 months, 1 week of stretching, and then, like, suddenly you're in playoff atmosphere, it's a recipe for disaster. And these other countries take it a lot more seriously than we do. I mean, I don't think America is really cares about it in any way, shape, or form.
I also don't like anything that makes guys who should hate each other like each other.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem in sports.
Right.
I don't want Jeter and Yukos to be friends.
No,
I don't want Jeter
that.
Like Pedroia.
I saw pictures today on the Boston Globe, I guess it was, of, you know, they were speculating about Euclid got injured in some late-inning comeback, I guess, against Puerto Rico in the pig pile at home plate. And they showed him jumping and, like, hugging Jeter. And it was the most uncomfortable thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
We talked about this before. Like, we as fans, we all want them to hate each other.
Yeah.
I don't want to see Jeter and Euclid, like, high-fiving and hugging each other. What happens when Jabba hits Euclid in the head at some point this season and there's a bench-clearing brawl? What's Jeter going to do? Well, I guess Euclid would be on the ground, and that's a bad scenario there. Let's say he brushes back Euclid and there's a brawl. Like, what's Jeter going to do?
I think it's going to be like hockey where the guys, you kind of just hold each other and you laugh a little bit while other guys fight. I don't like it, though.
And then you're Jabba, and you're like, hey, what's going on here, Derek? We're teammates for 162 games a year, and you're not going to have my back against Euclid?
Yeah.
You played with him for 2 weeks, and, you know, he did the towel dance for you or something, and you got a kick out of it? You know, I don't get it.
On the other hand, I did watch the comeback the other night, and, you know, it was pretty exciting. I got to say.
Puerto Rico?
Hey, listen, we showed Puerto Rico his boss.
Yeah, take that.
Take that.
Like when the Netherlands beat the Dominican Republic, so do we now think that the Netherlands has better baseball players than the Dominican Republic?
Well, I have an issue with that.
They have bragging rights for 2 years now?
We have to solve this thing about, like, how Randall Simon is Dutch? How is Randall Simon on the Netherlands?
How did it work? Like, you had to have, like, a Dutch grandparent or something?
It's so stupid. Like, Chris Kamen played for Germany in the Olympics. Like,
right.
We got to figure this out.
You can't be a free agent when it comes to countries. It's even worse, and it's even worse when it comes to women's basketball.
Oh, yeah.
In the Olympics, well, that's pretty much a blanket statement that always applies in any circumstance. But in this circumstance, I'll just forward the emails right to me, Billy. In this circumstance, it's about the Olympics. I was reading in Sports Illustrated around the time of the Olympics where they talked about some woman that got cut from the U.S. team, who's some big WNBA player. So she was like, guess what? I'm Russian, and you can apply to be like a Russian citizen in like 5 minutes.
Right.
She speaks no Russian. She'd never even been to Russia, and now she's like representing Russia in the Olympics.
I'm going to say her name was what? Katie something.
Yeah, Katie something, I think. I mean, that's like completely pseudo. It's one thing to be a free agent in professional sports, but you can't be a free agent when it comes to your country. Suddenly
right.
I'm Russian because I can be the starting point guard on their team. What?
Was it Katie Douglas?
Maybe.
Katie Douglas, right. Yeah, that's who it was.
Katie somebody. I just remember reading the article about it.
Come on, Katie.
I mean, you gotta, you know, you grew up in the Cold
War. Oh, no,
War.
You know who it was? It was Becky Hammon. That's who it was.
All right. Just found
it. Yeah, come on, Becky.
Come on, whoever. That's ridiculous. You can't go play for Russia. Didn't you ever see Rocky IV? You're going to switch sides? Come on.
Yeah. She filmed Rocky VI. I just want a gold medal.
Yeah, I just want a medal. And I don't understand how that works. Like, if you have a coach that's Russian and they're like, speaking in Russian, sitting up the break or whatever, you're just standing there like, yeah, okay, I'll just do whatever because I don't speak Russian.
I don't get it.
And then like you're on the medal stand and they play the national anthem. What are you supposed to, how do you react to that? Do you have any emotion at all?
This is why we should have amateurs in the Olympics.
Yeah.
Not people who do this professionally and have alternative agendas.
Right. I saw a thing, I guess it was in some magazine the other day where Mike Hargrove is like the bench coach for Italy. That's another thing. Like, you're the coach of Italy. They showed Mike Hargrove in a thing, in a jersey. It says
that's
Italian.
Weird.
What, really? Mike Hargrove? Doesn't sound that Italian to me.
I like the fact that Davey Johnson was available to coach Team USA. How'd they get him? He's like, really? Are you paying me in cash?
Exactly.
Can I get that up front? No checks.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, the WBC. And does it get any kind of ratings? Probably not, right? Unless people are really hungry for baseball.
My buddy Gus claims that the ratings have been pretty good. Gus, you know, the diehard baseball fans, thinks he loves the WBC, thinks it's the greatest thing ever, totally into it. And I guess because of the crowds, it's fun. I'm debating going to Dodger Stadium for a game.
Now, what stage is it in? To be honest with you, I don't even know. Like, is it like into the final medal rounds or whatever now?
Yeah, we're in the semifinals and the finals. It's at Dodger Stadium.
But the U.S. lost yesterday, right? Does that mean that they're eliminated or no?
No, I think it's like, I think if we lose, we have to lose 3 times to get eliminated, but the other countries only have to lose once.
Nice. I do like that setup.
We made up some rules. You know, it's funny. I can't remember where I heard this. It was on either SportsCenter or on the radio, and I think it was SportsCenter, but the guy goes, yeah, it was the night they come back, and the guy goes something like, yeah, Team USA, they're going to make the semifinals, and I'll tell you who's happy about that. The people selling tickets at Dodger Stadium. And then he goes, And that's not to slight Puerto Rico. Like, it was like he went into apology mode because that's what our culture is now. You have to apologize for everything. It's like the Puerto Ricans are going to email him, hey, what about us? We sell tickets too.
Yeah, so exactly.
We had to go into this whole spin when the reality is, yeah, Team USA is going to quadruple the ticket sales at Dodger Stadium. I think that's a pretty safe bet.
They should just make it like the America's Cup used to be, where like there was the America's Cup, there was, because America had it for 150 years or whatever.
Yeah.
So there was like one race for all American boats. They automatically would have an American in the finals, and then every other country would have to like race to be the challenger.
Yeah.
So it was like America was always in the finals. You just do that in the WBC, the same thing.
You know, it's another example of that, Johnny.
What's
Karate
that?
Kid 3. Daniel-san got a bye all the way through the All Valley Karate Tournament to the finals.
You know, I don't think I ever saw Karate Kid 3.
Oh,
I think
God.
They lost me. Which is the one where he... Oh, no, I saw Karate Kid 3. I'm sorry. I didn't see the one where he went to Japan.
Karate
or the one
Kid,
with Hilary Swank.
Karate Kid 3 was the one when Daniel-san and Mr. Miyagi, when it kind of went to a level that none of us were ready for.
Is that the one where that featured Thomas Ian Griffith?
Yes, Holy Cross the Zone.
You know, Thomas Ian Griffith and I went to the same high school and the same college.
And then he devoted his life to destroying an 18-year-old karate prodigy.
Yeah, we used to talk about that in college. Like, we were mystified by the fact that this guy was like this millionaire and or billionaire, whatever he was supposed to be. It was this big,
yeah,
wealthy guy and, you know, good-looking and had all these women and whatever. And he dedicated his whole life to destroying a 15-year-old.
I liked when they brought him the cars. No? Too nice-looking? No? Yes! That's the car right there. Yes. Yeah, it was there was a lot of holes in the Karate Kid 3 plot. And you know what else wasn't helping was Ralph Macchio, about 35 at that point, had a woman's ass. Had a woman's ass. Hey, speaking of Holy Cross, quickly, because I don't want to miss this Cal State Northridge upset.
What's
They're up
the score?
up one with 8 minutes left.
Oh my! Let me just crumple up my pool right now.
So Holy Cross, I talked about this with House yesterday in the podcast.
Yeah.
Holy Cross, well, you know, we talk ourselves into the Patriot League finals. We might make it. Who knows? And then they throw up the 18% shooting in the first half.
Oh, God, I watched it. I was going out to dinner with my wife and another couple, so I couldn't, mercifully, I couldn't watch the whole game, but I did make time to watch the first half. And it was just, I mean, it was just abysmal. I mean, their shooting was just, I mean, to call it horrific is an understatement. So bad.
Are you on board with Div 3?
Well, I mean, all I want is, we've talked about this, but why can't they just improve and be competitive? Would that cost the school so much in terms of academic credibility?
Well, do you support my plan of...
Yeah, I mean, you've said for years they should just go NEC, SAC, or whatever. Next.
No. That's one option. The other option is to just get young coaches who are going to use the school as a stepping stone. I call it the stepping stone philosophy.
That's great.
Yes, come and use us for your first job for 3 years, and then go use us and go to BC or Maryland.
Absolutely. That's such a good plan. But see, any coach worth his salt is going to want to do what, you know, there was always a huge rumor when we were in college that Holy Cross was allegedly the first school asked to join the Big East.
That's not a rumor. That's true.
But they turned it down. And then there was, I don't know if it was the same rumor or a different rumor that they wanted Cousy to be the head coach. And Cousy was like, I'll be the head coach, but you have to like do like Notre Dame does and ease up on the academic requirements to get in terms of basketball so we can be competitive. And the school was like, no, we wouldn't do that. So that's why we are where we are. So I think any young coach is going to want to do, you know, I'm not saying you should let in people that have no business there. You know, we're not going to become like UNLV with junior college transfers and what have you and forward the emails to UNLV, from UNLV to me as well.
No, they admit it.
But, you know, but you can let in some athletes that maybe wouldn't certainly have the SATs to get in necessarily, but are still good students, but can play basketball and are blue chip athletes that can put the school on the map to some degree. I'm not saying we're going to be Gonzaga, and we're certainly never going to be Georgetown.
Why can't we be Gonzaga? But, we could be Gonzaga.
Well, I would like, because that's just such a dream that's so far away. I was just trying
it's
to.
It's not, though. All you need is a coach. You just need one coach who's going to, who is an up and comer, who's going to bring a couple talented guys. Then other people watch the school on TV, and they say, cool, Massachusetts, 40 minutes from Boston.
Right.
Tommy Heinsohn went there. Bob Cousy went there. Yeah, I'm in.
A huge tradition of basketball. And it, you know, we liked, when we went there for, you know, it was a decent football school in terms of 1AA. But, you know, football.
Decent.
Is
we were like undefeated.
Yeah, I know. In our 4 years there, they had 40 wins, 4 losses, and 1 tie.
Yeah.
I don't think they've had 40 wins in the 18 years since we graduated.
No.
But For basketball, it's much, you know, smaller numbers. You don't need to have football team is what 45 guys. You don't need that many guys for basketball, obviously. And you're not talking about having everybody on the team be, you know, not academically up to snuff. You just need a couple of blue chip guys that, you know, maybe you make some bend some of the rules for to get in, and they can play basketball.
Like blue chips?
They said, like, just like blue chips. Go get Shaq and Penny Hardaway.
Ricky Rowe gets a new tractor.
That's right.
To come join us. Penny Hardaway's mom gets a new job and a new house. Butch, I gotta watch that again. Listen.
But
I'm volunteering my services to be in charge of the How to Make Holy Cross Basketball Better Committee.
And it would be so good for the school. You'd have, like, you know, people get interested in the school. They increase the number of applications to the school. People that want to go there, you know, it puts the school back on the map to a degree. Instead of, and it would get the alumni to kick in more money because
yes.
They're fired up about it. Instead of, like, now watching, you watch it on TV and they're down by, they lose by 16 points to freaking American University. You know?
I haven't given money in 3 years and I'm not going to unless they make a decision. It's too important.
People would so get behind that, the alumni. Everywhere we go, we see guys we went to college with and, you know, we go to football games for tailgates and stuff and people are always like, God, I wish we were better at basketball specifically.
Well, Jesus, like, look at the guys we went to school with. Everybody we went to school with was a diehard sports fan who loved to play. I mean, that was like 75% of the school when we were there.
Right.
Sports was such a big part of everything. It's so short-sighted to me that they won't take advantage of it. And whatever, if they don't want to do it, fine. Then let's play Amherst and Williams.
I mean,
let's go that way.
Look at Georgetown. Georgetown's like a near Ivy League school. It's one of the best colleges in the country.
Yeah.
And has their academic standing taken any kind of a hit because they have a competitive basketball team year in and year out?
No.
And I'm not even saying Holy Cross has to be Georgetown. That's like the Mount Everest of where we could someday be that we'll never get to. But, you know, could we be Gonzaga? Is that so wrong?
No.
Is that so wrong, Bill?
We could easily be Gonzaga. Easily.
I mean, you know, it's just so frustrating. Year in and year out, and you get excited, and it's just like they have the same team every year. Ugh.
All right, we got to wrap this up because I want to watch the end of this game.
Right.
But hold on. Did you watch Real World last night?
I did not. I pathetically, I DVR'd it, but I did not watch it. I did not see last night's. I saw last week's, but I'm up to date through last week, but not last night.
An emotional episode. The Iraqi kid has now turned into maybe a top three favorite character in the history of the show for me.
Really?
And
leading up to last night or after last night?
Just the whole season. I just really like him. I think he's one of the few roommates I've ever had that I'd actually be friends with.
He's one of the few that's real.
Yeah.
Exactly.
He's a totally normal guy with a sense of humor and you know, meanwhile, he served our country and all that. And
right.
You learned in the last night's episode that he actually was a really respected soldier and won a couple medals and all that stuff.
Oh, wow.
And then at the end of the show, they call him back to Iraq. I don't mean a spoiler alert. I spoil it for you, but.
Really?
He gets a phone call that he's got to go back in April. And in all seriousness, say what you want about the Real World and you know, what an exploitative show. And God knows they've had threesomes and hot tubs and, you know, some of the most embarrassing kind of TV moments, stuff you wouldn't want to see your kids. But this is one of the realest moments I think I've ever seen on the show.
Really?
And not just on the show, I think on television.
In life.
The guy, you know, he was just like a zombie, like just couldn't believe it. And finally he breaks down, his roommate's consoling him, and it was just really sad.
Wow.
Where I'm watching my wife, my wife, she'll start crying during like a commercial. And so I'm really into it. I'm not even thinking about her. And then I'm like, I look over and she's just like, her whole face is twisted. Just a complete, nobody has ever cried harder at a Real World episode ever, I don't think.
Wow.
She was a mess for like 10 minutes after. But it was really sad. So I asked Joe Mead, I think we got to get this guy on. I want him on the podcast. He goes to Iraq on April 15th. And I don't know. I just felt bad for him.
Oh, because
he had served his country. You know, he's out there for 3 years and he did his duty. And
I mean, things are much more stable now over there than they were. But still, you've put your life on hold and things that you want to do. And now he's got the chance to, you know, be a celebrity here to some degree. And now he has to go back over there. You know, it's a... All these troops make an incredible sacrifice for the country, and we can never repay them for the debt of gratitude that we owe them.
Well, and also,
exemplified by him.
And you don't think that when you watch a show like this, you don't realize, like, that these guys come back and it really takes them a long time to readjust. I mean, we saw it in the Vietnam movies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big theme. I even took a special class when I was in college about like the effects of the war and the people who came back, all that stuff. But it's just easy to forget. And this guy has friends who, you know, come home, they're home for a month and they shoot themselves.
I know. And I mean, there was the one. There was the episode of The Real World that was around 9/11 this year when he and another guy that was in his battalion or whatever, they were going to do a march in memory of 9/11, and he talked about things that he had to get used to being back home and things that bothered him, and he talked about like the sight of garbage bothers him because I guess when he used to be on patrol, that you know the enemy would put IEDs, these improvised explosive devices, in garbage.
Right.
So he's seen, you know, garbage blow up and, you know, Jeeps blow up or Humvees blow up, rather. So even something like that that you completely take for granted, like you're driving down the street and it's trash day and you see garbage, like he's kind of like, ooh, garbage.
Yeah, it's a flashback.
Right.
Right.
So, like, little things like that, certainly, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, I thought it's such a weird show. Like, it's a show that arguably is the most exploitative show ever that's been successful for this long. You know,
oh, yeah.
And then on the other hand, the Pedro Zamora thing, that was like Pedro Zamora was the first guy I knew who had HIV and died. And I didn't know him. I just knew him from the show,
TV.
But he put a face on it for me.
Right.
And this guy, Ryan, as weird as it sounds, has kind of
put a face on the American veteran for you
in a weird way.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, are we going to watch the Pedro movie together? I think I have to fly back.
Absolutely. We'll make plans for that.
It looks fantastically bad.
Really bad. The clips they showed on their screening of it last week were not Academy Award worthy, that's for sure.
Yeah, if their goal was to drum up interest in the movie, the only interest they drummed up for me was the unintentional comedy interest. Because it looks awful. I mean, a very cool idea for a movie, but it almost seems like the better idea would have been to do a really elaborate documentary about him. Because they have all this footage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they have all this movie.
It's a little weird.
I mean, I'm fascinated by it though, because is there a character that plays Puck? I mean, is there like a guy that acts like Puck?
Yeah, they had a scene where they had all the real world cat. I'm sure they're going to do the peanut butter scene.
Fantastic.
You did not put my finger in your peanut butter, in my peanut butter. It's disgusting. I do not know where your fingers have been. Pivotal scene of real world history.
It's pretty big. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll have to get together for that one.
Anyway,
all right.
Yeah, so we're going to get that. I'm sorry to bring you down at work.
Sorry.
I thought you had seen the show. You're all depressed now. You're just going to go home.
No, I'm okay.
All right, well, okay. I want to get that Ryan. I want to get Ryan on before he goes, hopefully.
Yeah, definitely.
And props to our troops overseas.
Tell him I said thank you for his service.
All right, Johnny.
All right, buddy.
So next week, baseball season started. We're going to call you to talk about the 2009 season.
Sounds good.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
So I get to sign off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
And that concludes another episode of the BS Report. And here's 55 more words that Bill Simmons intended to mention, but unfortunately ran out of time. Now you can get any regular pile-high Subway footlong for just $5. The keyword is any. The sweet onion chicken teriyaki, savory chicken and bacon ranch, the meaty taste bud pleasing Italian BMT. All the regular famous Subway footlongs, just $5. Subway, eat fresh. See store for details.